be terribly expensive, but since it's going to be called a medical equipment, you factor in $1,000 extra for whatever it is. So it's not going to be cheap. It's probably a lot more cost effective to hire a decent phlebotomist.
Send the near infrared.
I don't know if you hear me, Wes. You got to get a new microphone again. This one's shot. It comes in, it goes out, it comes in, it goes out. I don't know, Wes. I don't know if you get me or not. With your microphone, with some guy out there doing God knows what, this is not very, I can't understand anything that you're saying right now. It's either your audio drops to next to nothing or there's some noise that's going over you. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, I'm going to try one more time. And 2XJN, can you hear me now?
Yes, I hear you now.
Okay, so fine. Okay, so what I said is that the infrared is projected on the hand, actually is sent into the hand, because of the depth of penetration, it is revealing the veins, and then that picture is taken by the camera, amplified, and projected back to the hand. So on the hand you see a bright picture of what your veins are. Back to you.
Okay, I mean that's certainly doable. You're operating on two different frequencies. Visible light isn't near infrared, so if you proper filtering and such, they shouldn't interfere with each other. It's sort of the same way the repeaters work. So, yeah, okay. But again, I'd be curious to see what how profitable that design will be. I mean, it's theoretically possible that rather than hire trained phlebotomists, some health organization will just kind of buy one of those machines and hire someone who just had previously been working on a McDonald's. They're trying to cut the cost, so that might be a solution. I don't know. Again, if I was requiring phlebotomy, I probably would prefer an actual phlebotomist to do it, rather than a incredibly brilliant professorial doctor who hasn't done blood drawing in 30 years, or someone who just came off of a McDonald's chip. Wesley, didn't hear anything from you. It's a shame. We have a whole bunch of people I'm looking at on the audio stream on the internet, and all they're listening to is noise from someone else. Maybe we should give this subject a rest for a couple of minutes and see if someone else has a question that hopefully will not generate a lot of background noise. Okay, Wes, we'll get back to you in a little while. Wesley, I can't hear you. I'm sorry. I was good. Options are the low-level hum with no audio or the noise in the background. So we'll give this a break for a little while. I'll call your name again, I promise you, Wesley, and hopefully things will work out better. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, very good. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This somehow continues to be the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. We got a bunch of people on the audio stream. We got a bunch of people on the Echo Link, and we have Ontario on the IRLP. So let's give them a good show. Anyone with any questions or comments tonight, in addition to all the people who've checked in before, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
N2YYC.
Yes, N2YYC.
N2YYC, regarding Echo Link, do you know if there's any kind of help desk? A friend of mine downloaded it to his phone and can't get it to work.
I think there's an email address available on their site. I've corresponded with them in the past, sometimes somewhat helpful, sometimes not terribly helpful. As I mentioned before, I got an email from them when I was unaware that you couldn't run two types of Echo Link on the same internet service provider. So I would just ask them to go to the Echo Link website and look for the email address and ask them. And they, at the very least, I'm sure there are many, many pages of instructions and advice for it. Offhand, do you know anything specific about his problem connecting, or is it just one of those it doesn't work type of things?
It doesn't work. You know, it won't connect.
Okay, I mean, has he registered with them? Because that's very important. When you start it off and you don't have a proper password, they require you to register with them by submitting some proof that you're a licensed amateur. And so if you don't, if it's not a registered ID, it just won't make a connection. So do you know offhand if he's registered with them?
I believe he did that. But they actually want you to send a copy of the license or just, give you a call?
no. They want a lot. Well, they want somewhat more than giving a call, because I could give a call. You could give a call. People without a license could give a call, and you could just make believe you're that person. You have to. There's about, I think, four or five different ways. The way that I did it was that if you log on to the FCC ULS site, there's two ways of getting a copy of your license. If you don't log on, you get a copy of the license that has a banner diagonally that this is just a generic copy. If you log on with your password that you have for the FCC ULS, it doesn't put that up. And so if you send someone a copy of your license without that banner, it means that you logged on to the ULS, so they know that you're legit. So that's the way that I use, but there's, I think, two or three other ways of doing it.
Are you saying log on and you have to email them a copy?
Yeah, if he has not registered with Echolink and needs to prove that he has a license, he can go on to the FCC ULS site and log on with his password and ask for a copy of his license and send it to them by email. That will suffice. Again, there are a couple of other methods, but that was just the one that I know of, because that's the one that I used. And they're pretty good about it. I thought it was going to take some time. I think I was registered in about 2 hours.
Okay, very good. I'll have to discuss that with him. I don't know if he did that. Thank you for the information. And 2YYC.
You're welcome. And if he has registered with them, I would either suggest that he contact them using the email, or just look at the website. There's a whole bunch. There's been a lot of guys before him that had problems getting things to work under different circumstances. There are some ports that need to be accessed in some cases, not others. So, there's more than a few little quirks to the thing. I wish him luck, and if you're so inclined, when he figures it all out, come back and tell us what the solution was, so that we'll learn from his problem.
All right, I'll do that. Thanks again. And to YYC.
Okay, very good. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. Anyone out there with any questions or comments for tonight, please hit that push to talk.
B2BX, Elroy.
Yes, Frank, how are you today?
I'm good. Expected the net to be quieter, but more people would be at Dayton. But maybe some of those people are coming through Echolink or All-Star on their way home. Well, the Hamvention really isn't strictly in Dayton anymore, but people still call it Dayton. In any case, I have, for the last couple of days, the ARRL's Logbook of the World, LOTW system, has apparently been offline. I know you're, I don't think you're a paper chaser, maybe Paul is, or someone else on here is. The story I got from a buddy of mine, and I didn't get a link from him, though I could, is that they were hacked, possibly by ransomware. I was wondering if you were, someone else on here, knew what was going on with that. So go ahead.
Oh, gosh, I didn't hear about that at all. I mean, I have the software on my computer. I have a lot of software on my computer. I don't really chase paper, so I haven't really availed myself. That would be terrible. Ransomware guys are sniveling little lowlives. you know, I mean, it goes beyond, you know, what, why would you attack an amateur radio hobbyist group of all things? But I, unfortunately, no, you're telling me this the first time. I'm curious if anyone out there knows anything about this, please feel free to share.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Yes, Alex.
I saw it in an article timestamped 5:15 p.m. that was served to me as a Google ad, actually, from sleepingcomputer.com. We know about that much, it looks like, that they say they don't collect Social Security numbers, but they're not saying what it was, and no one knows whether it's ransomware or something else. ADCDU, over.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did a quickie Google search while you were talking. There's apparently it's been going on for about 3 days. So, geez, that's terrible. But, you know, I mean, that's unfortunately what these ransomware people tend to do for a living and make other people's lives miserable. So we got to keep an eye on that one. Maybe next Sunday we'll tell you how it all worked out, if it all worked out. But these guys are nefarious, and they supposedly work under a set of rules that they seem to violate regularly. There was some rule among some ransomware for people not really aware of what's going on with this. It's a very strange thing. A bunch of guys basically build tools to break in to servers and encrypt and lock down the data once they've broken in. And they usually don't directly do the dirty work. They basically contract out. So, you know, a group will come to them and say, you know, we'd like to use your software to break in, and we'll give you 10, 15, 20% off the top. And then the smaller groups kind of do the grunt work. And the theory was that these ransomware super groups have rules that you don't kind of impact hospitals or places where it impacts people's lives. You know, something that if you disrupt it, you could basically screw up a hospital infrastructure and such. But they violate those rules regularly, so that's kind of what ransomware is. So we'll keep an ear on the ground and see what the future shows for us. I think it's mostly conjecture. There's even a YouTube on the subject, ARRL Hacked, ARRL Logbook of the World Outage. When Paul's doing the SpaceNet report, I'll post the YouTube onto my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. So that apparently, you know, there's not that much information, but that seems to be a thing for the last few days. Frank?
Okay, yeah, it sounds like more information is coming out about it. I think a part of it is that the most of this people who would be involved were at Hamvention this weekend and busy with that and, you know, not prepared to deal with this. Now, what I find particularly strange is I think historically some of the really good hackers who would do this kind of thing are hams. So why would they bother LOTW? They use it. At least some of them do. Anyway, I guess there's not much more we can say about this right now until everyone gets home from Dayton or Hamvention, whatever they call it now, and starts getting into this and posting more information about it now. Go ahead, Roy. WB2BX.
AC2GS. I don't know. I might quibble with you. I think most of the personnel of ARRL that went down to the Hamvention, probably not the IT people in charge of the computers. The one thing, I've mentioned this before, so I'll mention it again. The one thing that sort of surprised me when I got my license, I kind of projected all hams being interested in all kinds of science and technology, therefore this technical net per se, to discover that people segment themselves. There's a lot of very brilliant radio engineer types who won't touch a computer to save their lives, and they certainly won't program anything, or they do it under severe duress. So I would be willing to bet almost anything that the ARRL staffs and IT department that it might, you know, might have a technician's license for the heck of it, but are not exactly dedicated amateur radio operators. There seems to be a significant divide between RF electronics and digital electronics, or at least I perceived it. It's getting a little bit better. When I first joined this fraternal organization 12 years ago, I would regularly bump into old-timers who wouldn't allow a computer anywhere in their shack, and they might have a computer in the living room someplace to send emails to their grandchildren. This has gotten better. More hams use them at least as logbooks and other tools. But there's still a bizarre divide in my mind between, IT and RF.
Yeah, well, Sirius ham radio contest stations, as you probably know, are highly automated. But, there probably are still quite a few hams who aren't. And the LOTW system itself was built something like 25 or more years ago, I think. And I remember hearing some talk by the ARRL president at the time saying they were looking for a replacement, and that was back 4 years ago during the pandemic. And the old DOS-based system, I think it actually is still up there. Well, maybe after this disaster, they'll be forced to modernize it now. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay. I mean, all things are possible. I know they've been tweaking the client end software repeatedly. I must have updated that software at least four times in the last 10, 12 years. So something's getting tweaked and adjusted. But, there's a lot of old equipment up there, I'm sure. And, it costs money to have programmers rewrite stuff, and so they'd rather save their money. You brought up the Hamvention, and I'm curious if anyone has heard from anyone who went down there. I was terribly disappointed this weekend. One of the companies that pre-announced that they were going to have an announcement was Flex Radio, the makers or the previous makers of my own little 6700, which they discontinued. And I don't know. I was kind of disappointed. What they did was the 67,000 was one of the what they called the 6,000 series models. Prior to that, they had 5,000s and 3,000s, but mine were part of the 6,000 series. So what they announced this weekend was the 8,000 series. I think it's 8,600 and the 8,400. With and without a front-end monitor and such. And it doesn't have as good specs as my 6700. It supposedly updates the lesser 6400 and 6600 models. One allows for two radio receivers and the other four radio receivers. My 6700 allows for eight. So I'm not impressed. They announced that the field programmable gate array is twice as powerful now as the previous models, and the CPU is four times as powerful. What are they going to do with that? Writing firmware that does things, then that might be important. But unfortunately, since Flex Radio hasn't really innovated firmware in about 3 years, I don't know what their plans are for firmware. So I love my 6700, but I feel as though Flex Radio's kind of let me down. I think they've found that the military contracts are probably a lot more profitable than amateur radio operators, and the last time they actually upgraded the firmware and charged people a couple hundred bucks, a lot of people yelled at them. So they probably decided to save the money and not ask for the 200 bucks and not change the software or the firmware. So I was disappointed this weekend. Anyone else out there disappointed or thrilled with some announcement that I've yet to hear?
Yes, there might have been a long time.
Yeah, I guess those people interested went down to Ohio, and then those that aren't stayed here and are listening. So it's for a hobby that's dedicated to communication, we seem to have a communication problem. You know, you would sort of think that this is one of the more important conventions of amateur radio, and yet there's no well-defined way of getting information out. You'll see a couple of YouTubes. Most of the YouTubes I prophesize will be of guys who just took their cell phone and shook it around put their thumb over the microphone so you can't even make out what's going on. And eventually, in a month or two, QST will do a little article on it. In a year or two, CQ will do a little article on it, and that'll be that. It's kind of a shame. We should get our stuff together there.
I don't think CQ would do a little article on it, because I think CQ could put Roy on.
Say again, your audio kind of broke up there. CQ is in a weird position, you know. One month they're not printing in a magazine, another month they're printing a magazine. They're kind of hobbling to the graveyard, unfortunately, I think.
Yeah. I'm kind of disappointed if I finally get an LOTW confirm for that. They'll be gone, and I won't be able to get the approval. I've been through all these years with a ham.
Well, you know, it's a shame. I've always promoted backup, backup, backup. I have backups of my backups of my backups. And if everyone industry and ARRL would do that, then ransomware wouldn't be quite the problem that it tends to be. Because you'd have a backup copy someplace. You might miss a week. I don't know if they have backups. My guess is as time goes on and less terrible things happen to you, you tend to get a little bit slow and lazy, kind of leave it for the next day. But again, we'll see. The YouTube was, I think, just published a few hours ago, so I assume that might be the most relevant information on the subject. Because there are other entries that go as far back as 3 days ago. So we'll see what the future brings. Trust nothing. Back up everything. If it's precious to you, then make sure you have a copy that's not attached to the Internet. Because anything that's attached to the Internet can be broken into under the right circumstances.
Yeah, very good, Roy. That wasn't actually my point. My point was that if CQ Magazine is completely bust, then I won't be able to get an official Worked All Zones WAZ award from them when I finally get the last confirmation I need for the award. That's a completely separate issue from LOTW being down. I can always upload my database again once they get it working, if need be. Anyway, I'll look at the video later, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more information coming out next week. WB2BX, so back to them.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll develop over time, and hopefully it'll be good news. I hope CQ holds on long enough to let you kind of finish the contest there, get your paper. You know, I've always kind of said it. I love magazines since I was a little kid. I lived and breathed, popular electronics, popular science. I mean, one of the many ways that I've realized Elon is a fake is that I read the same futuristic articles back in the 60s that he cribs for his inventions to this very day. So I'm very thankful that Scientific American seems to be going strong, but so many of my magazines have faded away and disappeared as web pages that don't get updated anymore. So we'll see what happens to CQ. I wish you luck in the contest, Frank, as always.
Yeah, well, that paper is an award, but not strictly speaking a contest, but there are some similarities. Anyway, I would like to finish WAZ at some point. Anyway, go ahead and see who else is around. WB2BXO.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Okay, just a quick story about the QSTs. The Elmer I had years ago, he was a doctor. And, you know, he'd read every month, he'd get a QST book, read it. And when he was done with it, you know, he'd put it on a big shelf somewhere and collect them like I did. He took the QST and he left it in the office, you know, with the People magazine and, you know, and all the other magazines that used to be out there. And he said, you'd be surprised how many people would be in the office, and, you know, when they come in, you know, they're poking around with the skin and all, you know, he was a dermatologist, and they would ask him questions about, you know, what's the story with that magazine after, you know, with the ham stories, and, you know, he says, a lot of people were interested. So he used to do that. Anyway, good story. I just wanted to let you know. Back to you.
Yeah, that was a very good story. I've been in doctor's and dentist office where occasionally you come upon some really unusual magazine that you've never heard of before or probably will hear again. That would be interesting to see people's reaction. Sometimes if you're bored enough, you'll read stuff that you don't have any particular interest in at the time, and you know, you never know how many hams he kind of created in his waiting room. That's a great story.
Yeah, and now I go to the doctor's offices. There's nothing there. If I don't have my phone with me, I'm in trouble. Nothing to read.
That's a shame. The magazine companies actually send doctors free magazines. So it's either they somehow missed them, or them, or they're keeping them at home and they're not sharing.
There might be a couple of them. You know, there used to be a lot. You know, there might be a couple still floating around. But they're far and few between, let me put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the magazine industry in general. I remember you could go to a candy shop and there would be racks of comic books on one side and racks of magazines on the other side. And I haven't seen those in decades. There just isn't enough to fill that much of a rack. Comic books also kind of took a big hit as well. I don't think quite as massive as magazines, but I'd say at least 85% of the magazines I've subscribed to in my lifetime have bit the dust, unfortunately. I still get a few more. You know, I mean, that's why even when the ARRL kind of went cutthroat and charged massive amounts for QST, I had to continue subscribing to it just for the sake of having some magazines to read. But We'll see what the future brings. Everything's going to be beamed to our brains directly. That's going to be loads of fun.
Go to Midtown Comics.
Very good. I heard comments. If it wasn't for my dentist, you know, my orthodontist when I was a kid with braces, I got a chance to read, because, you know, you go back and forth a lot. I got a chance to read countless Mad magazines this guy had. Anyway, I heard somebody else, Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, I don't think he has a license, so you can listen, but you can't talk, Jack. Anyway, gee, that's a great dentist. My dentist never had Mad magazines. I had to pay for my own Mad magazine, which I think is still around vaguely. I don't know if it's on quarterly or what, but last I saw, they were still vaguely around. But my youth was filled reading Mad magazines.
Okay, very good. I'll let you pick it up again. Yeah, Spy versus Spy. That was one of the better ones. I'm listening. WSW.
That's not me, jamming.
Anyway, yeah, I like Spy versus Spy. There were so many things. I like the smart-ass versions of popular movies. I like the rear page where you folded it in half and you saw kind of a secret message and a secret set of pictures. I'm just going to talk over you, so I don't know if you want to waste your time doing this, but I guess feel free. Anyway, anyone with any questions or topics for discussion or comments that has a license, please hit that push to talk. Everyone didn't kind of run out of power there. We still got a good amount of time. I mean, you know, we could do a short version if that's what everyone kind of wants. But I'd like to at least attempt the usual length of a technical net. So this is not a monologue situation here. It's a dialogue. So again, if anyone has any comments or questions or topics for discussion, please feel free to push that button.
WA2VDH with a question.
Certainly, John.
Yeah, my question has to do with, this is more of a, I guess, a biological question. Do you have any thoughts or comments on how noise shows up or affects nerve impulses? Have there been any experiments where people have injected Gaussian noise into nerve fibers to see how it affects the transmission, or is there any cases where there is noise that's actually present in on a nerve impulse or signal, and what is its effects on the propagation through the nerve cell? Go ahead.
Okay, that's a esoteric and interesting question. I'm not exactly sure of the up-to-date specifics of neurophysiology and such, but it sort of kind of touches on something that I'm sure a majority of people listening tonight are aware of, things called TENS units. TENS units are electrodes that introduce signals down nerve endings that are supposed to improve pain management. It has never particularly been fundamentally proved. It's more anecdotal, the concept that the TENS units jam nerve endings, the pain receptor nerve endings, to diminish the nerve conduction of pain. But I'm sure there are guys out there in neurophysiology labs kind of testing animal nerve cells in that means and method. I don't know if they've definitively found anything. My assumption is not, because then it would end up in the literature and I would end up reading it. So I'm sure there are people who are working on all kinds of signal insertions into small nerve bundles to assess their effect on sensory nerve endings.
Yeah, the reason I was sort of wondering about it is that I know the communication along a neuron, I think, is mostly electrical. However, the link from one neuron to another, I believe, is chemical. And I was just wondering how that chemical link between nerve cells would have, what effect it would have on noise. Would it tend to have an averaging effect or something like that, right?
Okay, again, it's an interesting concept. Yes, what happens at the nerve body itself is neurotransmitters are released that open ion channels that produce an onrush of different ions, which produce an electrical potential. The rest of the conduction along the nerve fiber is still highly biological and chemical because they require myelin sheaths and further ion channel activations. So it's not like, I wouldn't kind of consider it purely electronic, because then I would think it is some kind of conductor. What's going on is actually charges are kind of jumping across myelin sheaths, activating ion channels that cause ions to flow in and out of the cell, producing voltage differentials that then trigger further chain reactions from myelin sheaths and ion channels. So it's still biochemical, bioelectrical chemical type of thing. It's not purely electronic, and probably by sending the noise down the conductor, you can probably change the tendency at the end for the end of the nerve cell to produce agents that continue the chain. So, I'm sure there's something with that. I don't know if it has to be Gaussian. I don't know if it's as sophisticated as that. But certainly you can jam nerve cells. And that's kind of what TENS units are meant to do.
How quickly do they propagate from point A to point B?
It depends on the type of nerve cell. Different nerve cells have different propagation rates. Pain receptors are relatively low. They're probably one of the more primitive nerve fibers in the body. That is why a lot of times you'll kind of drop a brick on your toe and you'll feel the pressure of the brick hitting your toe, and then an instant later you'll feel the excruciating pain of the brick hitting your toe. It's because your pressure receptors travel at a much higher propagation rate than pain receptors.
Oh, that's an interesting point. I think about these things every time my trigeminal neuralgia acts up and pushes me closer to a suicidal tendencies. But anyway, I appreciate the comments. Thanks.
You're welcome. Yeah, and I feel for you. That's a terrible problem to have. It's like all things. People who don't suffer it kind of don't really know how bad it is. It's kind of like when people who have migraines tell people who don't have migraines that they have a migraine and they think it's a tension headache. So I feel for you. I wish there was a solution to that.
Well, the solution I usually start thinking about is the final solution, a la Sherlock Holmes. But anyway, thanks for your comments.
You're welcome, John. And I hope you don't travel down that road. There are a lot of chronic ailments that drive people crazy, unfortunately. And, you know, again, I wish there was a solution for it. Maybe someday there will be. Thank you, as always, for participating. I always appreciate it. If anyone else has any comments or questions or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Yes, Alex.
So I bought a Faraday bag on Amazon. I had one on phone size to put my work phone in it, so work can't track me if I'm off duty. And I got one laptop size. Now, is it? I read about like EMP stuff, and you guys mentioned in a lightning strike, there's like almost a mini EMP if it's not a direct strike. Would keeping a spare radio in a Faraday bag be a good idea, or is that like being crazy? I just don't know if I'm nuts. 82 to you.
No, I wouldn't call it being nuts. It's not definitively the solution. Faraday cages aren't binary objects. They will diminish the electromagnetic field, but they won't negate it entirely. And it sort of depends upon the magnitude of the pulse, you know, how thick a Faraday cage you really need. You know, I mean, usually if you have a radio that's turned off, that's usually all that you need to do. Once you power it, the front end is very sensitive to EMPs, and then you're definitely going to have problems. But is there any downside to sticking a radio, even though it's turned off, into a Faraday cage? No. It, you know, like I said before, it's a belt and suspenders. You know, no one, gives you a fine for wearing a belt and suspenders. So I see nothing particularly wrong with that.
WA2BSM with a question.
Yes.
Good evening. Just a general question about a Faraday bag or cage. In order to provide some, I hate to use the word insulation, but protection from EMF, don't these Faraday devices have to be grounded?
Not necessarily. They work better if they're grounded, but they're attenuators is what it amounts to. They sap some of the RF energy out of the field. If you can apply it to a good ground, you can. It's a much more efficient device. But if you know, we have a lot of electrical equipment that is built in a cage that isn't necessarily grounded to anything. So it'll work to an extent. As I said, it's much more efficient if you do apply a ground to it.
Can you accomplish 100% attenuation if you have a good ground? Is that theoretically possible?
Probably no. You can get closer and closer to zero, but you probably theoretically cannot reach zero. It's a kind of asymptotic relationship to the efficiency of any cage like that.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, Roy. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Take care. Have a nice evening. We'll be listening out.
You're welcome, Stu. So, Alex, did we answer your question, or you got anything else that you want to tell us?
Yeah, that's helpful. I wanted one of them for the laptop, and it came in a 5-pack. So I got some other. I just threw some other things in them during that solar storm. I didn't know if we found out any more about like if the solar storm had knocked out electronics that weren't shielded. I didn't see a ton of follow-up articles about that after the storm itself. Over.
I don't know for sure, but I would assume there wasn't significant outages because I would assume that it would become a big news item and clickbait and all kinds of stuff because almost anything becomes clickbait these days. So the geomagnetic storms producing much more aurora borealises and screwing up F1 and F2 and making my life on a 10-meter net very local. But I don't think it's knocked out any significant equipment, because I haven't heard any. I'm sure if it did, someone would yell and scream and run with it.
It's fun to put your tinfoil hat on sometimes. I'll be out listening back to that. Thank you for the information.
Okay, belt and suspenders is not a terrible idea. Better safe than sorry. But just know your limitations. Just because someone put a commercial out on a product, if you're really curious, get yourself some kind of RF transmitter and a signal meter, and then put the signal meter in the bag and see how the signal decreases. Because if it's a sensitive enough signal meter, it's not going to read zero. It's going to read some attenuated signal. Then at least you'll get a rough approximation of how decent your Faraday bag is. When RFIDs and other things first came into the consciousness of humanity, every dicey guy sold wallets that were RF-proof, that really weren't. Fortunately, I think most wallets that are advertised as RF-proof are a little bit better than the first generation or the second generation. But, better safe than sorry. I wouldn't call anyone paranoid. You never know.
I think they're basically just tinfoil lined bags at this point, is my guess. But it seems to keep the phone offline pretty well. I've tried to call the work phone. I love the idea that my boss can't track me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's just a conductive shield surrounding your RF generating equipment. The thicker it is, the more attenuation it produces. Depending upon what the wavelength is, you can get away with punching small holes in it. So, it could be kind of like a grid work, and it would be just as effective as if it was made out of solid metal. So, ultimately, it's just a conductive bag. You could do it with more finesse or less finesse, but that's what Faraday cages ultimately end up being. Okay, once again, I continue to be AC2GS, and this continues to be the technical net, Limark's own little technical net. We still have a little bit more time. If anyone has any topics for discussion or comments to be made or questions to be asked,
AF2P Ed with a question.
Yeah, sure.
Does anybody here has anybody used heat sink tape to not only affix the transistor, MOSFET, whatever, to the heat sink, but also to dissipate the heat? And how effective is it? I know it's not as effective as the paste, but I wonder if anybody's used it and can comment. That's the question. Thanks, Roy.
Okay. Well, let's see. We'll throw it into the audience, and hopefully someone will respond. I've only used thermal paste. My rationale is that paste is going to get into the nooks and crevices of the heat sink and the heat sinkable material, and you'll have a much more efficient dissipation of heat as opposed to a piece of solid tape where any of the imperfections between the surface of the tape and the things that you want to thermally dissipate is going to knock down the efficiency. But anyone out there use thermal tape instead of thermal paste?
WB2EAZ, the answer is no, but I have some thoughts.
Certainly. I'd love to hear your thoughts, Ed.
The classic thing for coupling something to a heat sink is, yes, thermal paste. There also are these products that are kind of like these thin, pre-cut, almost rubbery pads called fill pads and the like that are almost but not quite as good. I would be very leery about trusting a tape, but I can't say that I have any hands-on experience.
Okay, very good. I'm curious about your opinion. In addition to thermal tapes and thermal pastes, there are, I guess, what I would call thermal glues, in which they seem to really stick hard and fast, and they're a major pain in the backside to remove. Have you used those, and have you found any particular benefit in thermal paste adhesives versus the general thermal paste that if you just kind of mechanically separate things, they kind of peel away from each other?
My take is if you're heat-sinking something, you are dissipating a fair amount of heat. Assuming it's a transistor, you're going to have a fairly high junction temperature. And the higher the junction temperature, the lower the life. You know, this device could wear out and fail due to long-term low-level overheating or maybe even high-level overheating. So I would think a paste would be the last thing you'd want in a high failure component.
As opposed to a glue? I would think the glue would be the worst thing.
Let me rephrase that. Any adhesive, I'm talking about, all right, the term thermal paste is really a thermal glop. It's kind of like toothpaste. The slip pads I've used, for a TO3 transistor, it's cut in the shape of a TO3 and you just slide it in there. And those are kind of almost like a very thin rubber. But these are the things that are even, you know, in some cases you might have a micro washer if there's a voltage problem at the thermal paste on the micro. But the point I'm saying is it should disassemble easily. What I'm worried about is if you have hot components that need heat sinking, they may have a higher than normal failure rate, and if they're glued down, that's against the point of the whole thing.
Yeah, I would agree with you. That was kind of my problem with my lovely little Flex Radio 6700. It's more of a computer than it is a radio, and it has two thermally controlled fans that are sitting on field programmable gate arrays, which cost a ridiculous amount of money and which are glued down with thermal glue. So you can't just kind of unscrew a couple of things and put a little bit of force on the heat sink and pop it and replace it when, you know, the heat sink fan assembly needs replacing. You basically have to pry the damn thing apart. So I was always questioning exactly why they chose to use a thermal paste that was more of a glue-like material than a gloppy paste that would be easier to remove and swap out.
I assume they don't want you to fix it. They want you to replace the whole assembly.
Well, in this case, no, because I shipped it back to good old Texas, and the people there slowly, carefully peeled it away and replaced my fans without screwing up my field programmable gate arrays.
Maybe they have some solvent that loosens the glue.
Yeah, very likely they did, and they certainly have a lot more expertise than I had to do such things, and that's why I've tinkered around my 6700 before. Every so often the firmware bricks itself, and the firmware sits on a actually encrypted SD card, so you can't burn a new SD card because it's encrypted. I had to send mine back to Texas, and they sent me a new one. And I got the instructions on how to pull apart and get to the heart of the 6700 and insert another SD card in its place. So, you know, there are some things that they let some people toy around under warranty, and there are some things that they apparently don't want you to toy around with. and, you know, prying apart heat sink assemblies from $1,000 fuel programmable Gatorades probably is one of the things that frightens most people.
Comment?
Yes, please.
You know, Roy, this is one of the things that has amazed me about software.